Today on Triangulation, we talked to Kyle Weens from iFixit. We're talking about the right to repair. We're talking about what's up with the T2 chip in the new MacBook Air. And we're talking about whether to repair or recycle.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Triangulation, episode number 373, recorded Friday, November 16th, 2018. Kyle Weens from iFixit. This episode of Triangulation is brought to you by CuriosityStream, a subscription streaming service that offers over 2,000 documentaries and nonfiction titles from some of the world's best filmmakers, including exclusive originals. Visit curiositystream.com/twit and use the code TWIT to get 1 month free. And by LastPass, secure every password-protected entry point to your business. Join over 43,000 businesses and start managing and securing your company's passwords today. Learn more at lastpass.com/twit. Welcome to Triangulation. This is a show where we talk to some of the most interesting people working in technology today. And we love technology, obviously, but it is not without its problems. And one of the big ones right now is that there's too much of it. And also, it's hard to fix what we have. And a lot of us end up just replacing it instead of fixing it. And then we think we're going to recycle it. And we don't really think about what really happens when we do that. And so I am so excited today to talk to Kyle Weens, who is the co-founder of iFixit. He has been on many of our shows. And we love talking to him because he is such an advocate for fixing your own stuff. Thanks so much for joining us, Kyle.
Thanks for having me. This is going to be fun.
I think so, too. So first, before we get, I know you have we both have iPad Pros in front of us.
We do.
Mine I'm using for some notes that I've taken on your work, and you are using Jibs because you've taken it apart and it no longer works.
inspirational,
But to teach, you use it to teach people. So let's first start. I want to start with your background. Have you always been interested in fixing stuff?
You know, I was interested in gaming before I was interested in anything else. And then I started kind of building my own gaming PCs. But you know, my grandfather was a tinker and he would always bring over electronics and we'd take them apart. And my first job, actually, I started working at a Apple repair shop when I was 14. They had me breaking down boxes and eventually they let me fix some things and I started having fun with it. But didn't start iFixit until I got to Cal Poly. I was studying computer science and I broke my laptop and didn't have a choice. I mean, I was a broke college student. It was my only computer. I had to fix it or I was going to have trouble getting homework done.
And so when you were working at the Apple store, what were the kinds of things you were fixing there?
Yeah, so this is a local independent shop, and it was in the era of the original iMac, so the Bondi Blue iMacs, and they actually had a handle on the bottom, so there was one screw and then handle, and you'd yank the bottom off, and then you could upgrade the RAM, and I think at the time it came with 32 megabytes of RAM or something, and so it was very common for people to want to upgrade the RAM, so people always be lugging in their big CRT iMacs, and we'd drop more RAM in and send them on their way. I remember it had a modem, and every time a lightning storm would come through, it would fry everybody's modems. And so we had a pretty good business just swapping modems on iMacs.
And back then, nobody gave you – I mean, was Apple giving you a hard time about doing any of that?
You know, Apple is always kind of – so the shop I was working at was an authorized independent shop in Oregon, and Apple gave them a little bit of grief. I mean, they've never treated the local independents very well. They wouldn't give them very good margins on products. They would kind of make it challenging. So that company eventually went out of business kind of because of Apple's predatory, I think, approach to handling the aftermarket. But it wasn't really until I got into college and I was trying to fix my laptop. And I was looking online like, where is the service manual for this thing? I knew what Apple's service documentation looked like. And it was obvious that I didn't have it anymore as a lowly college student. And Google didn't have it either. And so that was this light bulb moment of, aha, there's some information out there that's not on the internet. What's the deal?
I love that that you just that was your origin story, like that is how you guys started. And so what did you do next? Like, did you just fix it and then put it online, or like how did you fix it?
The first time you take anything apart is a pain in the neck. If you talk to anybody, I was taking apart my chainsaw this weekend, and I was actually pretty easy to take it apart, and then I had no idea how to put it back together. I was desperate for a repair guide. It took me 5 minutes to take it apart and something like 2 hours to get it back together again. And it's that way with electronics. It's that way there with everything. So with my laptop was a clamshell G3 iBook. It had the handle. Great computer, 800x600 screen. It was fantastic. And I tripped over the power cord and it was wobbly, and I knew just to drop a solder on the power jack would fix it. But the process of getting it open and getting disconnecting all the various plastic latches is kind of like a maze inside. Figuring that out was really tricky. And I got it apart, and I remember going to bed and waking up the next morning and looking at all the parts in front of me and saying, oh my God, what have I done? You go through the process of trying to put it back together. And eventually I did, but it was, and I fixed the computer mostly, but it was never quite the same. And I thought, okay, well now if I did it again, it would be easy. And so that was, well, let's just get some guides online. And so the initial set of repair guides that we wrote, we took it apart again, we took some pictures, and we figured, well, people are going to be taking their computer apart, so we'll do printed repair manuals. So the first six guides that we wrote were printed. We laid them out in InDesign, and we printed like 50 of each of them, and we figured we'd sell them for our cost or something. And that didn't work at all. Nobody wanted to buy a manual. And so out of a kind of peak of frustration, I said, well, I'll just put them online for free. And that was the moment that it took off.
So, yeah, I mean, I posted this on Twitter a couple months ago, because I had fixed my robot vacuum based on information like a YouTube video. And I was like, what did people do before YouTube? How did people fix things before they had this? And it was just like partly we fixed them because our moms or our dads helped us fix them, but partly it just things weren't as complicated back then. And so I'm sure things have even changed a lot since your first manual that you, when you were printing them, what year was that? 2000, 2001?
It was 2003, I think.
2003. Yeah. So since 2003, like how has the technology in the things that you've been fixing and putting up manuals for, how's that changed?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I remember writing a repair manual for the PowerBook G4 12-inch, which was it was the really powerful compact computer. And it was pretty darn complex to take apart. So I don't know. I mean, the biggest trend that we've seen, and this is really in the last 5 years, but has been adhesive in products. So they're not necessarily more complicated, but we're having to evolve and have new kinds of tools for working with these things. I think the complexity arises not from the complexity in any given product. It's the number of things that we have. Typical home has something like 38 different electronic gadgets. And each of them has a battery that has a finite lifespan. Each of them has a power cord you got to keep track of. And so you might be good at fixing iPads. It doesn't necessarily mean you're good at fixing laptops. That kind of like specialization of the types of products we have is I think the bigger challenge. And that's not a trend the last 15 years. That's really a trend in American culture over the last 50 to 75 years, the number of discrete types of things that we have. Back in the 50s, if you think about how many gadgets were in a kitchen, it was not very many. Mm-hmm. And now you've got a microwave and a can opener and a the list just goes on and on. A fancy blender and a toaster and an espresso machine. And if your espresso machine breaks, is there a local espresso machine repair guy? Probably not. So it's the kind of specialized doodads and gadgets that we have that adds complexity.
And it's the computer, the technology inside them, right? I mean, as well, like our microwave, we moved into a new house last year. We had a brand new microwave. And it just broke one day, pressed a button and it went and it wasn't working anymore.
Right.
And, I called Kenmore and I think that's who, and they said, well, the fixing is going to, it's going to cost you more than a new microwave. Yeah. And I was like, how is that possible? Like I looked on the microwave online and, they finally sent somebody out because I complained, but there was no way I was going to be able to fix that because it was all onboard diagnostics or whatever it was. Like, it was there. It was something that I wasn't even able to fix if I could.
And I think we're definitely seeing that with the household appliances. It used to be a refrigerator or a stove would last 20, 30 years. And now my local appliance retailer says expect a stove to last 7 years. And that just seems crazy to have an oven only last 7 years. But that's been driven by the electronics inside these things. The electronics just are not as durable as the rest of the product is. So this is where we get to say, well, hey, we are a electronics repair organization. We're good at teaching people how to repair these things. So what if we take our knowledge that we've learned from fixing iPads and apply it to home appliances? Mm-hmm. And so I've been having fun with that.
So, yeah, I mean, I don't think that was something I realized. Like, you're known for the teardowns of every new piece of technology that comes out. But when I looked, there are all kinds. And you have such a great community. Like, you can fix your Instapot or your – I didn't actually look to see. But maybe that microwave does have a repair guide created by you guys or their community on iFixit.
Yeah, I don't know how many microwave guides. I'm always have to be careful. People say, do you have a repair manual for, an Instapot? And I'll say no. And then you go and you look, and sure enough, we do.
Yeah. So let's talk a little bit about the teardowns. When did they start?
We started, so there was a Japanese website called the Kadawara-san, and it's run by this guy Mitsunobu Tanaka, who is he's actually a researcher at the Red Cross in Japan, and he's just an Apple fanboy and always has been, and he would buy the latest gadgets and take them apart and put them online, and everybody would cover it, and everybody would be trying to interpret his Japanese. And this was back when Google Translate wasn't as good. And so it was kind of this mystery, like, what is he saying? But he's got these amazing pictures inside the new gizmos. And so we started kind of following up and doing the same thing. And so it was a little bit of a race between him and us to say, hey, there's a new MacBook. Who can get it apart and online first? And I struck up a friendship with him. We started emailing back and forth. At some point, he said, look, I'm just doing this for fun because I want to see what's inside these things. If you guys are going to do it anyway, I'll just pass the baton to you. And you guys do the teardowns, and I'll write about what you're doing in Japanese. And so since we kind of struck up that friendship, we've both been doing it ever since. And check out his site. He has great Mac content. It's all in Japanese.
Okay. And so how do the teardowns Do you do them basically to prove whether something is repairable or not so repairable?
Yeah. I mean, at first it just started out, we were curious. We knew we were going to write a repair manual for it anyway. So let's get an early start on the repair manual. And then we realized that it was an opportunity to have a discussion at the time the product was coming out, when people have a chance to decide whether they want to buy it or not. Can we recommend this product or not? And there's lots of people. You do a great job. The tech world does a great job of reviewing products, but nobody was talking about how easy or hard it would be to fix. And part of that is because you don't know unless you take it apart. So, like, it is absolutely impossible for me to give you a recommendation or a repair score on the product until we've disassembled it. We just don't know. And so every time we open something up, it's a surprise. And so with this guy, it was interesting because there's these new adhesive tabs on the battery that we had only ever seen in one other iPad, and they did it in kind of a different way. And so you can see the adhesive that we're pulling out in that step, it stretches and releases. And so we've been begging Apple to put this adhesive in these batteries for a long time. It seems like finally they're listening to us, and we got really excited. We pulled it all out, and then the battery still didn't come out. And I think, I'm not sure if you want to switch back over to my camera, I'll show you where the pull tabs came out. So there were pull tabs on this side here, and then there were pull tabs here, but this section here had regular adhesive underneath it, and so you can kind of see the wrinkle pattern. But we were able to release the adhesive everywhere else except underneath here, and then we had to like aggressively pry and almost damage it. So it's like Apple got almost there on making it easy to replace the battery and then stopped for some reason.
And so can you put that back together? Will you put that back together?
Yeah, we can and we will. We didn't damage this in the product. We've gotten pretty good at opening iPads. We haven't, like, with the new Microsoft Surfaces, we pretty consistently break those when we open them. Mm-hmm. But I don't think we broke this one at all.
And does that have as much glue in it as the new iPhones do?
It's got more. The iPhones are actually pretty good. So on our repair scores, we always rate the iPhones. The iPhones are actually some maybe the highest rated like mass market smartphone out there in terms of our repairability scores, where these devices are pretty low. This is better than past iPads, kind of in the respect of the battery, but there's still, I mean, there's adhesive all the way around the inside. And one kind of challenge is that the adhesive is relatively thin, so you got to get in and slice the adhesive as you go around, but not go so far in that you damage the display. And part of why it's helpful to have a repair manual is to know where the cables are, where the little, you know, cameras and things that you can impact. Mm-hmm. Like there's this little component here.
And so I thought there was more adhesive because in the phones, because they were waterproof. Is that not true?
Yeah. Well, yeah, but they use a kind of adhesive gasket, but it's easy to remove. So I guess the difference would be it's this very thin, small, like you can just use a suction cup and remove it. You don't need the like heating and prying and process that we have with the iPads. I think they have more problems with structural rigidity on the iPads, and so they have to use, I think, more glue. Mm-hmm. Clearly, if you say, well, why did Apple use the pull tab adhesive everywhere except right here? I have a feeling they got close to the end of the design. That was the plan, and they realized they were not getting enough rigidity. It's interesting to note that they only did that adhesive on the side that has is this the SIM card slot? I don't know.
I don't know. What is it? A speaker?
The microphone is over on the other side.
I think it might be the speaker.
The speakers are all around the corners. Anyway, you got this big opening on the side of it, and that opening creates, if I kind of flex it here, you'll see there's a fair amount of flex in the frame. And so I'm guessing that they needed additional glue to use the battery as part of the structural rigidity for it. And we see this a lot. Apple is so aggressive at going thin that there are trade-offs, and the ability to like fold the iPad in half is a serious concern. As Zach over at Jerry Rig Everything found out. And so I think maybe this is a attempt to reinforce it. They were hoping they could use, I would guess they were hoping they could use the easy to remove pull tabs and then ran into problems.
Mm-hmm. So I heard a talk that you gave where you said, you know, that a lot of us, and I am one of those people that do that, is, you know, when we're done with a device, we put it in a drawer.
Yeah,
because we feel bad about getting rid of it because it's worth something, and we leave it in that drawer until we don't feel bad anymore, and then we just get rid of it.
Right.
So
yes,
what
this is not abnormal. Most people do this. Yeah. I've been guilty.
And I did that with an iPhone 6, but then I got a kit from you guys, and I would like to say that I replaced the battery, but my 13-year-old son replaced it, and then now it's his phone. And, you know, I think we've had extra phones that I've tried to give to him, and he says, no. I mean, because he's very happy with this 2014 iPhone 6 that he replaced the screen and battery on. So what would you recommend people do when they open that drawer of guilt instead of just feeling guilty about it? What would you recommend they do?
The best thing to do is the most selfish thing, which is to sell it and get as much money for it as you possibly can. and the reason for that is if you think at the macro level about all of the cell phones in the world and all the people in the world that might need them, anybody who needs a phone is going to go out and buy one. If you buy one used, then that's a phone that you're not buying that's manufactured new. Globally, we make somewhere around 2 billion cell phones a year, and it's a huge amount. It's hundreds of pounds of raw material that go into manufacturing any given phone. And so every time you have the chance to buy something used, you're supplanting the manufacturing of a new thing, which is fantastic. Like the most green cell phone is the one that you already own. And so if you do need to upgrade and get a new one, the best thing that you can do with your old device is to get it to somebody else. So if you sell it on Craigslist or you sell it, you know, to Gazelle or one of those sites, that's awesome because they're gonna get it to somebody that's going to use it. Someone will put a new battery in it. As long as people are willing to pay you money for it, that means it's value. It means somebody is putting money on the line to make sure that they are going to use it.
Mm-hmm. And you should do that quickly because the longer it sits in the drawer, the less money people will.
The less money you're going to get, the less use. If you think a phone, if you say, well, a phone, you know, maybe you're only going to have a phone for 2 or 3 years, but maybe the phone's life could overall be like 8 years. Like there are still people buying and selling iPhone 4s on eBay, and they're worth something like $50. So that's an old phone, then that's totally fine. So the goal is to get that full, you know, 8 years of life out of the device. Even if you're not using it, somebody should use it.
And so when you say sell it to someone who's going to use it, you mean on eBay or well, you still can on Amazon. And as, instead of like offering it to the cell phone provider, I mean, what are they
you
likely
can,
to
You can
do
sell it?
It
to them too. They generally are refurbishing and reselling them. Yeah, there are some conspiracy theories that they take them and they destroy them, that they shred them. But I think the carriers, it's enough, there's enough money in it for them that they're going to that they're going to refurb and resell it probably. But you're going to get a much better deal if you sell it to somebody. I really like the website swappa.com. I bought my wife a new iPhone 6S on there the other day, and it's great. It's like eBay without the suck.
Oh, Swappa. Like Swappa
for cell phones.
But you, okay, great. Good to know. And so what about refurbished and what about refurbished stuff? Like, I know you can buy refurbished stuff from Apple. What about buying refurbished stuff, whether it be from a big company like Apple or not?
Yeah, no, I think refurb is always great. Usually, if you're getting refurb from a big company, it hasn't really been refurbished. It's somebody bought it and then changed their mind and returned it. And, you know, the packaging was missing the manual or something. And so they had to send it back and repackage it up. And so those are usually great. It's funny. I saw Apple is selling the HomePods now refurbished. They just launched that. And if you saw our teardown of the HomePods, the whole thing, it's actually this really nice screwed together base. And then they glued the screws together. So there's absolutely no way Apple is like dismantling and fixing and refurbishing these HomePods. It's just, you know, they're just buyer remorse type products. So there's no problem at all buying those. I think it's great. Is it environmentally better to buy a refurbished product from Apple or a new product from Apple? I don't know, maybe. But certainly if you buy, like Amazon's got their sort of, you know, their kind of Amazon Renewed program where you can buy devices that have some higher quality standards. I'd say generally they're great. It really just comes down to who you're buying it from and making sure that you trust that merchant. Mm-hmm. If you're buying it on Amazon, it's not about Amazon. It's about the seller that you're getting it from.
Right. I want to talk about what Amazon is doing now that they're going to be selling Apple products. So kind of leaving.
Yeah.
I want to talk about that. I want to talk, of course, about the right to repair. I want to also talk about your teardown of the new MacBook and the T2 chip and what we kind of have learned about that, which has to do with the right to repair. But first, I want to take a minute to thank our sponsor, CuriosityStream. If you're watching this, you're curious and you like watching videos that will quench your curious thirst. CuriosityStream is the place to go if you want to learn more about essentially anything. And if you like to learn by watching videos, I know I remember the best days at school were always the ones when the VCR came in on the little cart. If you're old enough, you remember the VCR would come in on the cart and you get to learn by watching a video. Those were always my favorite days. CuriosityStream is the world's first streaming service that addresses our lifelong quest to learn, to explore, and to understand. It's founded by John Hendricks, the founder of the Discovery Channel. It's available on Roku. You can get it on Android. You can get it on your Xbox One, on your smart TV, on your Apple TV, Chromecast, Amazon, your Amazon Fire, your Amazon Kindle. You can get it on your iPad, your iPhone, any iOS device, and it's available worldwide. The content spans science, nature, history, technology, society, and lifestyle. Award-winning documentaries, including Stephen Hawking's Favorite Places, The Hunt for Dark Matter, Birth of the Internet, and the Cyber War. So any of those things, I love watching CuriosityStream. It's kind of the best way to just sit back and just learn stuff. You can get unlimited access starting at just $2.99 a month. Would also make a great gift for the curious people in your life. Check out the premium plan that includes Ultra HD and 4K streaming. Go to curiositystream.com/twit for unlimited access to the world's top documentaries and nonfiction series. And for our listeners, enter promo code TWIT when prompted during the sign-up process, and your membership is completely free for the first month. That's curiositystream.com/twit, and use the code TWIT, and then you will get the first month completely free. And we thank CuriosityStream for their support of Triangulation. All right, the right to repair. We're talking to Kyle Weens, co-founder of iFixit, a great advocate for the right to repair. Explain a little bit. I mean, it used to be that you bought stuff and then you could fix the stuff because you've bought it. Why is that not true anymore?
I think it's as there's some inevitable process where companies get big and then it gets big enough where, you know, people are out there fixing things and then the manufacturer starts to provide their own repair service. And then they realize, hey, we're competing with these local folks. What is there a way that we could take business away from them and grow our slice of the repair pie? We see this happening in industry after industry. And the only industry that's ever successfully fought back has been the automotive world, where your local independent mechanic can fix any car. And the reason that they can fix any car, even the new crazy computerized ones, is because there are right to repair laws that have been passed that protect their ability to do that. In other industries, like, for example, camera repair, the SLR cameras, every photographer that has one, if it breaks, of course, they're going to fix it. Well, it used to be the local camera shops could do those repairs. But several years ago, Nikon decided that they were going to stop selling service parts to the local independent camera shops. And within I'd say a matter of months, maybe a year or two, thousands of camera stores around the U.S. went out of business. And Nikon's rationale was, well, people are going to get it fixed either way. They'll just mail it in to us rather than taking it to a local shop, and we'll be able to grow our repair business. But what happened in actuality is it just created another friction point for people with cameras. They stopped going to local shops. Local shops closed down, and they switched to using their phones, and it kind of hastened the death of the camera industry. And so we've seen this kind of approach play out in other industries. The TV companies used to provide local shops, and used to have a TV repair guy in your neighborhood that would come and swap a tube, and the TV manufacturers would share schematics, and it was this happy symbiotic place. And that went away. TV manufacturers stopped providing information. There's an overarching trend where manufacturers are going to tend to monopolize service because they can. And it's really up to society to decide, well, do we want to protect and incentivize repair or not? And so in the case of cars, we've decided that we want that. We passed lots of right to repair laws. The most recent was in Massachusetts in 2012 and then expanded nationwide. But we haven't passed those kinds of protections for other kinds of products.
So when you're saying the right to repair, you're not just talking about the right for me to repair my device, but for local repair shops the one that you worked at when.
Yeah. This is all about control. It's a question of who can do the work. Is it only the manufacturer and their authorized shop? So at Apple, it would be Apple and the Apple stores, or is it something that, you know, I could do at home, or I could go and hire a professional.
Mm-hmm. And so what you spell this out really well on the repair.org. What do you believe is the right, our rights to repair?
Yeah, well, fundamentally, I think that if you own it, you don't really own it unless you can open it, right? So I think people should have access to tools to be able to open our things. We should have access to software if it's needed in order to fix it. Maybe you need diagnostic software in order to connect and fix your tractor. And we need access to parts. So it's really, I mean, it's just the fundamental building blocks of what you need to be able to maintain something. You need information, you need tools, you need parts.
And so let's talk about the new Mac, the T2 chip, which Apple talked about. Well, it's for security, but there's something else in that chip that will make it harder for people to repair their devices on their own.
Yeah. So and we didn't know this when we took it apart. So this is the new MacBook Air with we took the fingerprint sensor off with fingerprint sensor. And so this has a T2 in it. And then you get the battery, and actually don't have the logic board in front of me. So the T2, this new, it's got the secure enclave for the Touch ID sensor. But what Apple is saying is that they're going to restrict access to repairs to people that have Apple's diagnostic software. So they've got fancy software. You plug it in to another machine, run it, or you can, you know, you boot off a USB drive or whatever. And if you install a new part, you have to use Apple's diagnostic software to synchronize the new display or the new logic board with the computer in order to make it work. And that's a new approach. We are very concerned about that because, I mean, like iFixit, what we do is we sell displays and main boards and things to help people repair their machines. So if all of a sudden you can get the new part, maybe you can take a part from another computer, but if you can't tell the phone to talk to it, or the computer to talk to it, then you're out of luck. And so we're not sure if this is – I mean, it really feels like it's a guillotine hanging over the neck of the repair industry. We don't know if it's going to be something that's in effect, you know, soon, or if it's something that they're just talking about to keep their authorized repair shops in line. But it's a pretty concerning development.
But this isn't in the – like I have the MacBook with the touch bar, and it has a fingerprint sensor, but that doesn't have the same –
We don't know. It's got a T2 chip as well, and so it could be they roll out a software update and prevent repairs of everything. We have not seen that yet. And in our testing, we've been swapping parts, and they've been working so far. But according to the service bulletin that Apple sent out this spring that's leaked, they're telling repair shops that you have to synchronize every new part with the software. So the concern is that we could get in a situation like what caused Error 53 last year or the year before, where people were swapping parts, they were fixing iPhones, putting new screens on iPhones, everything worked fine, and then Apple rolled out a software update and bricked phones that had been repaired 6 months or a year beforehand. So we need to see some kind of guarantees from Apple. And I think it's really interesting because Apple, on the one hand, is fighting right to repair legislation. They're fighting against the solution, and at the same time, they're doing everything they can to lock down repairs. It seems like if they keep acting like this, they're going to guarantee that right to repair passes because society isn't going to stand for it.
Mm. So the most recent win, right to repair win was we have the right to create our own diagnostic tools.
Yeah, that's pretty much it. So I will explain this quickly. The world of copyright is a little bit complicated, but fundamentally there's a law passed in 1998, the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, or DMCA, you may have heard of. And there's a piece of the DMCA that says that it's illegal to break locks that protect copyrighted content. So the goal of the law was to make it illegal to break open the encryption on DVDs and make copies. But they wrote the law in an overly generic way where the law says it's illegal to break any lock. So that means like jailbreaking your phone. You're breaking a lock to get in and install apps that aren't from Apple on your phone. Or it could be that in order to repair a tractor and you need to get in and break past locks that manufacturers put on there in order to make the settings changes that you need to fix the tractor. And this is the case across the board. So there's a escape hatch built into the law where you can apply for exemptions. Every 3 years, we apply for these exemptions, and we applied for a whole bunch of repair exemptions for the ability to repair IoT products, consumer devices, things like the Amazon Alexa or Echo, and farm equipment. And we got a big win where the Copyright Office finally, after years and years of going back and forth, writing legal briefs back and forth, they decided to grant a pretty wide open exemption for the purposes of repair. So that means that it doesn't mean the manufacturer will give you their service diagnostic software, but it means that it's now legal to write your own if you want to.
Have you done that, written diagnostic software?
I haven't. I mean, I have a group of folks that I'm working with where we're working on reverse engineering John Deere's diagnostic interface. So we're working on it, but I expect it will take a many years. It's a big, complicated machine with lots of, I mean, the bits flying across the wire, kind of crazy, lots of diagnostic codes. But if you're interested, we have tractorhacking.github.io is our site, and we're working on it.
So when I go get my Prius fixed by the local lady who fixes it, and she has, you know, all of the, well, here's what code number, whatever means, does that come from Toyota, or do the car repair places create those themselves?
Yeah, no. So you'll get a code that's like P1413 or something. Those are somewhat standardized error codes. You can get a scan tool that plugs into the OBD 2 port, the onboard diagnostic port that's right underneath your steering wheel. You plug it in there, and then you can get these really cool apps on your phone that will tell you your RPM, your fuel efficiency, and all that. And it will also tell you if there are any error codes. And those error codes are mostly standardized, but there are also manufacturer-specific codes. And that is that's part of, you know, the existing right to repair agreements, is that you have access to those codes. And then the Massachusetts agreement says that starting with the 2018 model years, that OBD interface is getting a lot more sophisticated, and there's even more repair data that you have access to, which is great. But only on 2018 and newer cars.
So would, like, in an ideal magical world, would you imagine like something like an OBD port on an iPhone?
That would be great. Yeah. I mean, you kind of already have it. You take your phone into, the Apple store, the genius takes it in the back and he plugs in their diagnostic software. So yeah, it would be that same kind of thing. You'd be able to see what settings have changed on it. One thing that Apple won't tell you is the actual battery health. They don't give you the stats on like how many cycles are on your battery. That's an obvious thing that you should know. On the Mac, in About This Mac, you go in the system profile, you can see how many cycles are on your Mac's battery, but Apple doesn't provide any way for iOS apps to tell you that unless you jailbreak it.
Mm-hmm. But there was some sort of new battery health.
They do, but it's just like your battery is fine or your battery needs help. That's it. It doesn't give you any more granular data. What you ought to be able to know is, hey, my battery lasts about 18 months. I'm going to need a new one in 6 months. That's what you ought to be able to tell. And you can tell that on your computer. Like, I'll go over here and I'll look at it on my Mac. We'll see how my battery is doing. I've got a 2012 MacBook Pro. It's fantastic. I have a 2 terabyte SSD in it because I can. And going over to power, let's see. So it says battery installed. Yes. Cycle count, 1359. So this is a 1,000 cycle rated battery, and I'm at 1,300 cycles. So I guess I'm doing pretty well for myself. It's probably time for a new battery pretty soon.
So Apple knows how much battery I have left in my iPhone or my iPad. They're just not telling me.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you can, it's an estimation because it's a chemical, wear. So you're going to the ballpark is the iPhone batteries last 500 charges and MacBook batteries last 1,000 charges. But it just totally depends on, your particular battery situation.
Mm-hmm. And what about how you charge it, whether you wait till,
that has no impact.
Okay.
So don't worry about charging your phone too much or too little. It's 500 charges is 500 charges. If you charge it halfway, that's half a charge.
Okay.
The bigger issue for batteries is extreme temperature. So very hot or very cold can be a challenge for them. And also, if you're going to store it for long periods of time, don't store it completely charged or completely empty. Store it 70% or so.
Mm-hmm.
But that's about it. There's not much you can do. The batteries are pretty smart. You can't really baby them.
Good to know. So I think of the right to repair as similar in some ways to the right to privacy. You always hear people saying I'm not doing anything wrong, so why do I care, about privacy? Why should I fight? Same thing. I'm not going to fix my stuff. I always have someone else fix it.
Right.
Why should everybody care about the right to repair?
Yeah, well, everything breaks eventually. You've got the second law of thermodynamics that says entropy is inevitable. All of our things will eventually decay. I think even if you're never going to fix anything or get it fixed, you're saying if anything goes wrong, I'll go and buy a new one. It's still going to having right to repair will increase the resale value of these devices because someone out there will fix it.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of impressive sometimes how much money you can get for broken things on eBay.
Mm-hmm.
So imagine if all the broken things in the world were all of a sudden worth 30% more because people were out there that could fix them. It's really just about the balance of power between us and the manufacturers. If we're going to drop $1,000 on a new phone, shouldn't we be able to make sure that the value of that phone is going to be preserved for several years?
Mm-hmm. And repair creates jobs as well, right?
Absolutely. I mean, you look at the independent cell phone repair world that's been created as a result of information that has been published on YouTube and sites like iFixit. You've had tens of thousands. I think last time I kind of ran a quick check on Google Maps, I saw something like 15,000 cell phone repair shops in the U.S. and more around the world. All those shops have sprung up and they're doing great service to the community. Local repair is, I think, kind of at the kernel of any town in America and any neighborhood. We depend on our techies.
Mm-hmm.
and we need to make sure that it's not completely limited to the big manufacturers. One thing that I think we don't always realize is when you centralize something, you disenfranchise parts of the community. So particularly rural areas are really hit hard by not being able to fix things. It might be easy for you and me to go down to an Apple store and get something done. But if you're in Alaska or you're in Nebraska, there's only 2 Apple stores in Nebraska, and it's a long drive. It's a big state.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, in the last few years, a lot has been said about manufacturing jobs disappearing, jobs with our hands disappearing, and whether they're going to come back or not. But these repair jobs, I mean, there is the ability for them to come back. I mean, if these right to repair, if this happens, we can get these. Where manufacturing, it's much harder to get those jobs back.
Absolutely. Yeah. Trump is doing his dangdest to bring manufacturing jobs back to America. And it's not really working. But I tell you, we can bring the repair jobs back. If you think about a cell phone. So I'm told that Apple pays Foxconn about $5 in labor to assemble an iPhone. So you have a $1,000 phone. $5 of that is labor that's going to the worker that's sitting there, you know, screwing the thing together. Okay, fine. So that's the amount of kind of job, you know, potential there is in China for assembling that phone. So bringing the phones back to the U.S., the best we're going to do is bring $5 in labor. But if we have repair happening on that phone, if you take your phone in and you pay somebody $100 to get a screen fix, maybe half of that is labor. You've created $50 in labor to maintain a phone that is going straight into the local economy. Every time you change the battery, maybe that's another $30 or $40 in labor. So over the course of the device's life, you can be creating substantially more economic activity here than you ever would with manufacturing.
And more than you would with recycling.
Yeah, recycling. The rule of thumb is that I think it is that repair generates something like 20 times as many jobs as recycling. Recycling is pretty, you know, large scale and automated, and the actual commodity value of these things is not very much. A cell phone might be worth $1 in raw material terms. If you melt it down and you get the gold out, versus fixing it, you know, you're going to spend $50 fixing it and then reselling it.
And so what are some of, I mean, you know, if you recycle an aluminum can, you know, it's just aluminum. But if I'm going to recycle this, I mean, what stuff is inside this brand new iPad Pro that they would have to get?
Yeah, it's kind of fascinating. So of all the elements on the periodic table, about 50 of them are in your iPad Pro. It's crazy. And I mean, we only use like 70 of them in anything ever. So it's one of the most materially complex objects in existence. And it's got all kinds of crazy elements in it. The electronics industry uses almost all of the world's supply of indium in the touchscreen. And we're projected to run out of indium in something like 17 years. The neodymium that goes into the magnets. And I don't know if you've tried, but I saw somebody, the iPad Pro actually will stick to a refrigerator. It's got so many magnets in it.
Yeah, I saw Marques Brownlee did that. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So that neodymium is not recoverable in recycling. Nobody knows how they do it. And it's a rare earth that comes from these really toxic rare earth mines in northern China. It's called the Baotou Rare Earth Mine Complex. It's one of the most toxic places on the planet. And it's where almost all of our rare earths come from. And nobody can recover that in recycling at scale. There's gold, there's palladium, there's silver, there's tin in the solder, there's obviously the aluminum case is significant.
Yeah, there's a lot of stuff in there.
Yeah, it's kind of fascinating and complex. And when they, I mean, they just grind it up and melt it down, and they're able to get some of it out, but it's a relatively crude process, and so you can't get a lot of the more trace elements that are also some of the really important elements.
Mm-hmm. Well, you said that we're going to expect to hear some more right to repair news coming soon. And I want to talk about that, what you can tell us about that. But before I do that, I want to thank our sponsor of the show, LastPass. This episode is brought to you by LastPass. Now, we all have so many passwords to remember, and our passwords have to be long, and they have to be a certain number of letters, and they can't use characters, and they have to use that, and they have to use this, and they're hard to remember, and you can't write them down. That's why I use LastPass. LastPass is an excellent password manager. It will create complicated passwords for you and remember them for you, so you only have to remember one password. And if you are in an enterprise, you should also use LastPass and have everyone who works for you use LastPass, because that's how you can protect your enterprise. At Twit, we use LastPass. Leo gives it all to us, and so we can use it for our personal stuff and for our work stuff. And it makes it easier to share passwords among us, the passwords that need to be shared and not share the passwords that we don't need to share. LastPass makes sharing convenient for employees while keeping access to corporate data secure. It even allows for full customization of access, including the ability to set the master password requirement to enable password resets and restrict access when needed. You can configure over 100 policies, access security reports, and create shared folders. You can organize database logins, SSH keys, software licenses, and all your business information. You can also protect your business with multi-factor authentication with LastPass Authenticator app. A verification button pops up on an employee's phone to guarantee they're the only ones with access to their accounts. And you can make sure that, I know with Twit we have to use multi-factor authentication. It makes it one step harder, but it is always safer. If credentials are compromised, the app ensures outsiders will not have access. LastPass password generator makes it easy to use unique random passwords that employees don't have to remember, and they don't have to write them down. Employees can log into LastPass with their Microsoft Active Directory credentials, so they truly only have one password to remember. They can focus on their work stuff and not the million different passwords that they've created, and they won't write them down on little pieces of paper and pretend like they're hiding them, but you can see the little corner peeking out and you know it's a password. You don't have to do that. Data is encrypted and decrypted at the device level. Data stored in the vault is kept secret, even from LastPass. No more copying and pasting from your LastPass app. Like I said, it has autofill-in, which is great. That is on Android P, so if you don't use iOS 12, and it's there too. Autofill functionality makes it easier for employees to seamlessly use LastPass across mobile devices. LastPass also offers LastPass Premium for personal use, LastPass Families for your entire family, and LastPass Teams for teams of 50 or fewer. More than 16 million people trust LastPass, the number one most preferred password manager. Learn more at LastPass.com/twit today. That's LastPass.com/twit. And select the products that are right for you. And we thank LastPass for their support of Triangulation. I am talking to Kyle Weens, co-founder of iFixit. So what's the future of Right to Repair? What are we going to start hearing about soon?
Well, so let me connect this in with LastPass. One thing that's been happening a lot lately is people are having to fix cell phones because they need to get their two-factor authentication codes off of them. Or even better, they've got their Bitcoin locker on their phone, and there's no way to get it unless you fix the phone. And so, like, increasingly, if you water damage a device, you have to actually fix the circuit board. So the repair shops have gotten really good at figuring out how to fix these things. But they are relying on schematics that fell off a truck in China in order to do it, because you need the actual kind of roadmap schematic of how the thing is laid out. So that's where Right to Repair legislation comes in, is that would actually legalize the repair shops using the information that they kind of already are using in a lot of cases. A lot of shops I talk to, I'll say, well, you know, why don't you get involved? Why don't you talk about Right to Repair? They say, because we're afraid they'll come after us, because we know that we're having to break the law a little bit in order to do the repairs that we need to do every day for our customers.
Well, that's another thing. I mean, people are scared to give away their old devices or their old computers. It's not just because they're lazy. I mean, but they just haven't had time to get everything off of it. And I know that's what I've done with old computers. That's what's kept them there, because it's just like, oh, I just need to make sure there's no stuff on there.
But if you have LastPass, it makes it easy to migrate.
That's true. And yeah, more stuff is on that. Like, this is the best time, yeah, I think, to
really
repair your devices, because so much of your stuff is on the cloud. I'm so much more comfortable that I'm not leaving stuff behind. Right. I can freely erase stuff. And, you know, as you've pointed out several times, right now, innovation is not as fast as it used to be in tablets or iPhones. And so we can keep them longer.
Exactly. Yeah, the phones are not getting dramatically better every year like they used to. So what you're going to see with Right to Repair is the legislative season starts up in January, and you're going to start to see more states introduce bills again. So this last year, we had something like 18 different states, including California, introduce bills. We're looking to see something like that again this year, where they're going to introduce bills, and then you're going to start having committee hearings. People will be testifying all around the country on the issue. You'll have local repair shops and schools and interested consumers, environmental organizations testing in favor of it. You're going to see Apple pull out all the stops and bring out the best lobbyists and the dirtiest tricks to stop it. And it's going to be a question of whether democracy can prevail or not. And it's really going to be up to all of us to speak up our voice, talk to our local representatives, and get it done.
I mean, is part of the problem that it's just, it's not really, we're not really quite sure what, you know, what government body is in charge of this? Because you have the case with the John Deere case, and then you have the Lexmark printer case. Like, those are separate cases, right?
Yeah, and we in the EFF and others are taking care of those. So what we need people to focus on is your state legislature. So mm-hmm. your state senator and your state representative, those are the people to talk to. And there's actually the chance, if you want to talk to them now, pick up the phone, call, you know, tell them you want to do right to repair legislation. Your local legislator could then introduce legislation. They're often very interested in doing it. We had a case in the state of Washington. The sponsor, Representative Jeff Morris, got a call from a local repair shop who said, hey, this is an issue for me. Can you come down? I'll show you my shop and what we're doing. And he came down. He was really impressed. He thought it was a significant issue. And so he introduced it in their committee, and they actually passed it out of committee in Washington. And then they just ran out of time because it was a short legislative cycle. So I think you're going to see action. You're definitely going to see action in Washington again this next year. And I'm really looking forward to it. It's going to be a intense fight, but it should be a lot of fun.
Yeah, but now would be a good time to contact them because they're not, you know, the elections, those were...
The election's over. You know who your reps are, and they're interested in hearing from you. And they're not in session yet. They won't be in session until January. So they've got time. They're in their districts. They'd be happy to meet you.
And you make it pretty easy at repair.org, right? To figure out how to, if you go there, you can figure out how to contact your representative.
Yeah, you can type in anystate.repair.org. So california.repair.org, and there's a handy form, and we'll figure out who your legislators are from your address. You can even punch in your phone and phone number and your zip code, and then we'll call your representatives for you and connect you to them.
Well, I want to talk a little bit more about your recent repair guides. You mentioned that the Apple phones have gotten better. So you kind of were excited about that, but then the iPads, not so much. Why were the Apple teardown, the iPhone teardowns, why were you excited about those?
Well, I'm thrilled that Apple continues to design these things in a way that they can be serviced. They are clearly designing the phone so that you can open it up, swap out the battery, swap the screen. It's interesting. Most... the way that mechanically the phones are put together, the most common things that break are the battery and the screen. But like on the Samsung phones, you have to take everything out to get at the screen. It's a substantial process to disassemble. So on the Samsung phone, it's relatively easy to replace the battery, but really hard to replace the screen. With some other designs, like on the Pixel 2, it's easier to change the screen, harder to change the battery. So what Apple has accomplished is a design that makes it easy to change both of those common components, which we like. And that's why I think we give them a 5 or 6 on our repairability score compared to a lot of these other devices that score quite a bit lower.
The Surface Book, for example, doesn't.
The Surface, yeah. Yeah, those devices are just a complete disaster from a repair perspective. They're really frustrating to work on. They're just balls of glue, and it's crazy. Some of them even have like a modular SSD inside, and if you could open it, you could swap out the SSD with a bigger one, but you can't possibly get them open.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm hopeful that Microsoft will see the error of their ways and improve the repairability of these designs in the future, because it can't get much worse than it is right now.
Well, tell me about your deal with Motorola. They're helping you with your guides, or tell us about that.
Yeah, so Motorola reached out to us and said, hey, we actually want to help our customers fix things. We don't have the network of local Apple stores that can fix things for customers. So could you put together a DIY repair option for us? And we said, sure. And we went off into our labs and we spent a lot of time tinkering with the phones, figuring out the easiest way to get them open. We wrote a bunch of new repair guides for them, and we put together these kits. And the kits have everything that you need to fix the battery or the screen in any of the major Motorola phones. So you get a kit in the mail, and it's got a eye opener, which is I've got one over here. This is one of our Motorola kits. So the eye opener is a sack of gel. And you put it in the microwave and heat it up, and then you can use it to loosen adhesive. It's much safer to loosen the adhesive on the outside of the phone than using something like a heat gun. And with an eye opener and some pry tools, it's pretty straightforward to open these things up. I'm plugging my battery back in. There we go.
And so you have lots of different kits, and the kits that fix iPhones and, you know, Pixels, and those were not provided by Apple, correct? And what am I looking at now? The Essentials
So that's our Essential Electronics Toolkit. I got this guy here. This is a toolkit for opening things up. Yeah. So I mean, this is what we're doing with Motorola is what we've done with Apple parts. The difference is that we can get parts from Apple. We cannot get parts from Apple, and we are able to get parts from Motorola. So a lot of the parts that we sell for iPhones are aftermarket components.
So that you've just reverse engineered them.
Reverse engineer them when we create. And I mean, we really stand behind the quality of our parts. We've got lifetime warranties on them. We do a really diligent job sourcing, but they're not coming direct from Apple. Where with Motorola, they are endorsing it. They've run our guides through a quality control process. And so it's an officially endorsed repair solution.
And so I know, you know, the thing that you showed off that would loosen the adhesive for safety, are these parts pretty safe to use? I mean, what would you recommend? I mean, I handed them over to my 13-year-old. I think I handed it over to him when he was 12.
Yeah.
But what kind of safety measures would you recommend?
Like, the risk is not to you. The risk is to the device. Uh-huh. So if you're not careful or if you go too fast, you can break it, right? So the trick is to follow the instructions very carefully and slowly. Take your time. Plan out your workspace, get some kind of a piece of paper or an egg tray or an ice cube tray or something to keep track of the screws and just follow the directions and you'll be able to do it. Mm-hmm. We've been talking with people since we've launched it. We've gotten a really high success rate. It's almost everybody who gets one of these things has been able to repair the phone themselves.
And then what about your repair guides? Are they how does the collaboration work? Because I know you have an open API.
Talk a little bit about that. Yeah, the repair guides are all a wiki. It's all open source. So you can access the API and write your own apps if you want. But the cool thing about the guides is that they're not static. So if we publish, you know, like with the Motorola guides that we just published, that's our best guess right now. That's what we think is the best way to open it. But we're going to learn. The more people that use it, there's an edit button on every step. And so if you come across a problem, you can go and make a quick correction. Sometimes what we learn is that we might say there's 6 screws on this one part, and on some phones there's 7, on some phones there's 6. Maybe they made a change in manufacturing. And so by having the wisdom of everybody that's going through these repairs, you know, collaborating together, the content gets better over time. That's one problem I have with YouTube. I like repair videos on YouTube. They're great. But if we publish a video on YouTube and we make an error, you can't edit the video later and fix it. It drives us crazy.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, and sometimes you have to go through a lot of YouTube videos to find one that's actually accurate.
Yeah, I was looking. There are 30,000 oil change guides for a Honda Civic on YouTube. and some of them are good. But it's up to you to find the good one.
And does iFixit have oil change guides?
We do have some, yeah. Yeah, and one thing we've tried to do, and you're welcome to do, is curate YouTube. So if you do find a great repair video on YouTube, add it to iFixit. You can just create a guide and just embed the YouTube video straight in there, and then we're kind of curating YouTube together.
Mm-hmm. So I said I was going to be talking to you on Twitter, and I got some comments, and somebody wanted you to talk about the U.S. Customs seizing iPhone screens. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, this is a significant issue. Let's talk about the Norway case, because this has actually gone all the way through the court. So what happened was a repair shop in Norway bought a bunch of repair parts. They were iPhone screens from the U.S., imported them into Norway, and Apple went after the repair shop and said, you are infringing our trademark by importing these iPhone screens in. And the reason is that, well, for example, I've got – so this is the iPad board. And if you look on the A12 chip, there's an Apple logo on the A12 chip there. And so hypothetically, if I imported this into Norway, I am transferring Apple's trademark across borders, right? So that's what they were going after them. It was like a legit part that was, you know, made by Apple, actually, that had the Apple logo on it. They're importing it, and they're saying that's a counterfeit. And the shop said, no, it's actually an Apple screen. And Apple said, well, prove it. And so this actually went all the way to the Supreme Court in Norway, and the Supreme Court said to Apple, you're crazy. This repair shop is engaging in legitimate reuse, and you sold the product, and you exhausted your rights when you sold it. So that's the kind of thing that's been happening to repair shops in the U.S. where shops are importing parts. Sometimes they're screens that have been sent overseas for refurbishing, maybe replacing the glass that's cracked, and then bring them back in. And Apple's been going after shops. Jessa Jones, a great YouTube celebrity who fixes phones and iPads. She had a shipment seized, and she's very frustrated because she's saying, look, these are legitimate products. So this is yet another tactic that Apple is using to try to stifle the repair market. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of infuriating and frustrating and unnecessary, right? I mean, this is a legitimate activity.
And there was a video that was circulating, I think it was from the CBC recently, where it was a YouTuber who fixed iPhones, and he brought in a hidden camera to an Apple store, and a genius was saying, like, oh, no, you just need to buy a new one.
That was a CBC kind of in-depth report, and they were just looking at the cost of repairs. And they said, you know, hey, how expensive is Apple charging?
Bless you.
Excuse me. How much is Apple charging people in order to repair things? And took in a laptop that, it turned out had a pretty simple issue. Apple said, oh, it's going to be so expensive, you should just buy a new one. Took it to Louis Rossman, a repair shop in New York, and he was able to fix it in about 2 minutes. Mm-hmm. And with that, he just bent a pin back, and then the computer worked again. So, I mean, this just goes to show you think, oh, I'll get the extended warranty or I'll trust the manufacturer. Well, you know, the geniuses of Apple are decent at what they do. But there are many, many people out there who are better at fixing these products than Apple's employees.
So what do you get questions about AppleCare? Like, do you recommend that people get AppleCare or not?
Yeah, I think you just have to look at your situation. I don't generally recommend it, but it totally depends. With this iPad Pro, it's so fragile and flimsy that you might want to consider it. It depends on your use case, but knowing kind of how hard they are to fix and challenging it's going to be to get parts. The Apple Watch is interesting. You can repair them. They're relatively straightforward to open. The problem is there are no parts out there. We get parts in every once in a while, and we sell out almost instantly of all the repair parts that we get. So that's something that you might want to consider. Where on a MacBook, I wouldn't bother. On an iPhone, I wouldn't bother because there are good repair options for those.
Where do you get the Apple Watch parts when they do come in?
We buy Apple Watches and take them apart and pull the screens off. It's frustrating. We'd like to have an alternative source. We'd like to be able to buy them from Apple. I mean, think how much money they could make if they would just sell us parts.
Yeah. And so what's their reasoning for not selling Apple Watch parts?
They just want to completely control the ecosystem. They want it locked down. It's like what they're doing on Amazon right now, where they're saying, you know, nobody can sell Apple products on Amazon unless they're authorized by Apple. They want to completely control every aspect of the experience.
And so they will say that they're trying to protect customers from fake Apple, things that don't work. What would you say to that?
Yeah, well, and I understand that, and counterfeit products are really a challenge. I don't know if the right approach is to completely lock out smaller retailers. I mean, they're saying that the only people that are allowed to sell Apple products on Amazon starting in January have to be buying at least $2.5 million in products every 90 days. That is really punitive against small businesses. So, I mean, yeah, it's one way to do it, and I guess they can run their business how they want. But when you start to then inject that business ethos into Amazon's got, basically 50% market share of sales online, it's going to, I think, really limit options for consumers.
So they aren't. So you have to buy a certain amount of product from Apple.
Yeah, so Apple's saying there are some refurbishers that can continue to sell on Amazon, but only those that have been approved by Apple. And in order to even apply to get approved, you have to be doing $2.5 million in sales a quarter.
Wow.
You don't necessarily have to buy them from Apple. I think they want you to buy them from the wireless carriers. But it means that, I mean, there's been a lot of mom and pop shops. This is something that local repair shops will do is, if they have a lull in between customers, they'll fix up devices that they have and then sell them on Amazon or eBay. I think this is going to be a great thing for eBay. but it means that Amazon is not going to be the best place to get refurbished Apple products going forward.
So do you think Swappa is a good place to get refurbished?
Swappa's great, yeah. And I've never really heard of counterfeit issues with Swappa. I'd be curious if any of your listeners have. If anybody's had a good or bad story experience with Swappa, I'd love to hear it. Mm-hmm. We got a great deal. We bought an iPhone 6S and got a great deal on it. And its battery was toward the end of its life. So a couple months after we got the phone, we threw a new battery in it. And it's been a fantastic phone. Mm-hmm. It feels like it's eBay before it got, you know, populated by all the scammers and you know. It's a really nice, clean interface. You can see the reputation, see the person you're buying it from before you get it. I swear I'm not being paid by Swappa. I don't really know anybody there.
Have we missed anything? Have we missed anything about right to repair or about iFixit or repairability guides or recycling technology? Have we missed anything important?
I think the key thing is just looking forward that we really have an opportunity here. This is a pivotal moment in time. We got to decide what is the course of the technology world. You know, we're shifting, we're adding electronics into all of the traditional objects that we had. And so traditionally, you've been able to fix, you know, your washing machine or your refrigerator when it broke. At the moment, we're having trouble fixing you know, tablets. So if we can't fix the problem with repairing tablets, then we're really going to have a problem fixing these smart, you know, home devices going forward. Mm-hmm. So now is the time to decide, do we want a world where we can, you know, maintain, repair things, make things last longer, or are we going to be a purely, you know, consumption-driven culture that you know, does what the manufacturers tell us to? And my concern with that path is that it's a straight line from a world where you can't fix things the manufacturers tell you how and when you should be buying, to the world depicted in WALL-E, mm-hmm. where we're all sitting in, you know, chairs surrounded by a world of trash. With everything, you know, we're just consumption machines. I don't want to live in that world.
Yeah, I mean, if you think about all the things with the environment that are beyond our control, like, you know, there are things that are within our control, and we should recognize what those things are.
Yeah, and I think we've seen with the activism around some other, you know, technology measures of the past and the progress that we've made on things like net neutrality that we can have a difference. We can have an impact. We have gotten as far as we have on right to repair because of support of people all around the world, you know, speaking up. This is absolutely something that we can get done. And we have a legislative fix. We've got all the lawyers have done all their homework. We've got bills that are ready to go. And now it's just up to us to talk to our legislators and get it done.
Kyle, thank you so much for joining us. Kyle Weens, co-founder of iFixit. You can find the repairability stuff at iFixit.com. You can find the repair stuff at iFixit.org and repair.org. You can find Kyle at Kyle Weens. And anything else? Did I miss a
That's
place?
That's it. Thanks so much for having me.
Oh, thank you so much, Kyle. It was great talking
this is super
to you.
Fun.
Thank you. And thank you for watching Triangulation. Triangulation records every Friday at 3 p.m. Pacific. We love having you in the chat room. You can comment, ask questions. That's at irc.twit.tv. And if you're not around at 3 p.m. Pacific, you can get it from any podcast catcher you have. Go to twit.tv/try. I'm Megan Maroney. You can find me on Twitter at meganmaroney.com. Subscribe to the show. Let us know what you think of the show. And if there's anybody you'd like to talk to, you can email me, Megan@twit.tv. Thanks so much for joining us. We'll see you next week.